But this looks almost like the takedown of a political rival rather than an episode of Me Too in China. And so the whole Me Too movement and the way in which tennis players have been calling this out fits the Western narrative about China very nicely, even though this situation may be something different. But I do find that, that the WTA's response to it was extremely unusual.
Hi, everyone, and welcome once again to the Sports Pro Podcast. My name is Owen Connolly. I'm the editor at large at Sports Pro. Hope you're well. We are getting to the end of 2021, of course, you'll have noticed. But we're going to be talking today about the couple of the events that are coming up in 2022 and, more pertinently, some of the geopolitical and commercial intrigue around the pair of them. Those are, of course, the Beijing 2022 Winter Olympic Games, and then at the tail end of the year, the Qatar 2022 FIFA World Cup. Lots of discussion about both of those events in recent days, and we're going to be picking up on some of that with Mark Dreyer, the founder of China Sports Insider. Welcome to the Sports Pro Podcast, Mark.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Delighted to have you with us, and delighted to welcome back as well Professor Simon Chadwick, Global Professor of Sport at EM Lyon. Hello, Simon.
Hi, Owen. Thanks for asking me back again. I'm glad I didn't cause too much damage first time round.
Well, we're giving you another chance. We're going to be hearing a bit later on from the chief executive of the Danish Football Union, Jakob Jensen, who has been talking to SportsPro staff writer Rory Jones about the DBU's proposed commercial boycott of activities organised by the Qatar 2022 World Cup Organising Committee. And we'll pick up a bit on that later in this discussion, Simon. But really, one of the the biggest global story in sport in the last couple of weeks has been the fate of Peng Shuai, the women's tennis player who spoke out, made sexual assault allegations against Zhang Gaoli, former vice premier of the Chinese government. What is the latest on that, Mark, as we're talking? Obviously, her censorship and disappearance and subsequent whereabouts have been a source of a lot of speculation. CCP has been trying to dampen that down. They've done that with the support of the IOC. They've created a video call with Thomas Bach, the IOC president, to assure everyone that all was well. WTA and others, including governments around the world, slightly unconvinced by this, but what's the latest as far as you're able to ascertain?
Well, no real developments because, of course, the Chinese media, it's important to remember, there's absolutely no discussion of this whatsoever in China because it's just been completely censored. So some of the state media channels have posted on Twitter in English, but apart from that, the foreign ministry fielded a couple of questions. But it's basically not getting reported at all in China. So the IOC video call and picture that was released from that is kind of the latest that we have. And it seems to be a bit of an impasse, which is going to go on for many months because, frankly, I'm not expecting tennis tournaments to be held in China in 2022 entirely, given what we've seen from COVID. And then we're looking at towards, the autumn, the full period of 2023 would be the next time that perhaps the WTA would be back in China. So, nothing really needs to get sorted from that point of view, just from a practical point of view, for getting on for 2 years. So this story is going to go like the WTA have put out some very clear questions, which have not been answered at all. And so until they get their answers, we're not really going to move forward. And I'm not expecting China to offer much up on that front at all.
You mentioned that there's obviously nothing, no coverage on state TV of the allegations in particular. Has there been much in the way of what's it like when a story like this happens? And obviously some people have access, such as yourself, to outlets outside the country, and some people are having conversations with people outside the country. What kind of sentiment bubbles through?
Look, I mean, there's 1.4 billion people in China. And I would say, really don't overestimate the number of people who are kind of trying to jump over that great firewall on a regular basis. I mean, this is one of many, many sort of, you know, blocked sites, blocked stories. Yes, there, of course, are going to be some people. And there were people, you know, who were kind of posting fairly oblique references on Weibo and sort of, you know, to try to get around the censorship. But you're still talking a pretty small percentage of the wider population. And it takes a lot of effort, you know, to continually talk about this. And when there's basically no news, censorship here is effective. You know, it really is. So maybe people will start to question when they're thinking, oh, why isn't there any tennis happening? But like I said, COVID has kind of, you know, put the brakes on there anyway. And so I think people are so used to censorship here to a certain extent that it, you know, this, they just kind of accept it to a certain level and think, well, you know, it's very political, very sensitive, and kind of not a shrug of the shoulders, but it's more a standard response here than it would be in the West.
This feels like it's a story that has, it's cut through in a way, because I suppose it puts everything at a nexus point, because between, you know, some of the accommodations that rights holders have been moving into over the last 10, 15 years when they've been hosting events in China, there's obviously the IOC and the Olympic movement heading to China for what are a very controversial Olympic Games. There's the threat of a diplomatic boycott, which we'll get onto in a bit more detail in a second. And then there are these kind of wider questions about the safety of athletes and the safety of individuals in this scenario. I mean, what would you say? I'll ask you first, Mark, and then I want to bring you in, Simon, on this. Why has this become such a lightning rod, this story, beyond, of course, the very serious nature of the allegations against a very senior official in Chinese government and the very real risk, as it seems, to the individual here in Peng Shuai?
It's a tough question to answer. I think we've seen the tennis community really rally around Peng Shuai and express their support. But beyond that, it hasn't necessarily extended across too many sports. Now, yes, she's a three-time Olympian, and so you've got the Olympic Games and people kind of drawing those connections. But, you know, tennis players aren't coming to the Olympics. If they were, perhaps we'd see a much stronger reaction. But, you know, I'm sure that she probably doesn't know personally too many Winter Olympic athletes. So it's possible that people might speak out on her behalf. But I would say if that happens, it's going to be more the exception.
Simon, what do you make of the way that this the way that this story has kind of drawn so much into it?
I am really surprised that this story has developed in this way, and I think it is symptomatic and a product of these ideologically binary times that we live in, where, you know, essentially people in the West and the values that they hold, the liberal values that they hold, and authoritarian China and the way in which people lead their lives, it's diametrically opposed. And I don't think it's an accident that the Pong case has garnered so much attention. You know, essentially what you have here is China and some individuals and organizations in China doing whatever it is that they do. And an organization that, let's be honest about it, is predominantly American. So WTA is based in Florida. The guy who heads up the WTA, Steve Simon, is from North Carolina. A majority of the board of the WTA are Americans. And so what you have here is a classic juxtaposition of two ideologies that not only are in conflict with one another at the moment, but I would go so far as to say is they actually don't understand each other. And take it even further, they don't accept each other. So I don't see this episode as being necessarily about Pong. I think it's more about the relationship between the East and the West, and more specifically, the relationship between the United States and China right now. without wanting to preempt anything that you're going to ask subsequently, Owen, I think what's really significant for me is whilst everybody was looking at the Pong case, at the same time, the Biden administration was briefing in Washington, D.C. that a diplomatic boycott of the games might be necessary. And I don't think that those two things are accidental or coincidental. I think there is an awful lot of briefing from Washington, D.C. and from hawks around the U.S. administration who probably don't just want to see a diplomatic boycott. They want to see a full-scale athletic boycott. And it is almost as though Pong, whatever has happened to her, has become almost like an innocent victim in something much, much bigger.
In fact, let's talk about that now, Mark. The prospect of a diplomatic boycott is something that gets a lot of coverage here and has been gathering for quite some time, particularly as the stance on what's happening to Uyghur people in China has hardened. And you have the US, and Simon alluded to it a bit there, but their stance has become very, very strong on it, and to the point that they have called the Chinese government's activities there a genocide. Let's set the scene a little bit before we get into the kind of the heart of the diplomatic boycott. What's the nature? What's the state of the preparations at the moment for Beijing 2022? How big a part of the discourse is that at the moment? What are some of the things that are being considered, and what kind of progress has been made towards those games?
Well, in terms of the diplomatic side of things, you know, China, of course, is very cognizant of what the rest of the world is saying. It's often hard to know how much does it really care about that, you know, versus its own domestic priorities and domestic audience. But, you know, it is beginning to respond to some of these things, saying, well, you know, well, we're not necessarily inviting U.S. politicians. So basically, if U.S. politicians say we're not going to come, China can say, well, we didn't invite you anyway. So, you know, it's a tactic. I think that, you know, Simon makes a good point in terms of the rhetoric from the U.S. Towards China right now. It seems to me that there's one issue on which, you know, both sides of the aisle, both sides of the political aisle in Washington are united. And that's basically that, you know, China's bad and, you know, we must take a tougher stance with China. And so this all fits into that. I would just kind of caution on the diplomatic boycott. You know, when we talk about boycotts in history, it's athletic boycotts, right? It's when athletes don't show. And so, you know, do presidents and prime ministers typically attend Winter Olympic opening ceremonies on the other side of the world? No, not really. So for me, it's a little bit of talk. How much does it really mean, you know, who attends and who doesn't? There's always a certain amount of, you know, negativity around every games, because until the Olympics themselves, until the action actually kicks off, there's nothing else to talk about. And then I'm not saying, you know, it should or shouldn't happen, but then everything else kind of gets forgotten as soon as we get to day one. And it's all in the rearview mirror. So right now, everyone's talking about this stuff, and you know, but you know, it's a little bit of a distraction, I think, to an extent.
Forgotten, perhaps by the watching public and by sports fans. Probably not forgotten within the corridors of power in Beijing or in Washington or whoever else might be drawn into a diplomatic boycott, I guess. But what would your read, Simon, be on the prospect of that kind of action being taken, and also the implications of it?
As we've already said, diplomats go to Olympic Games and they go to sit there at the opening ceremony and wave a flag for when their team goes past, and that's one part of it. And obviously there is an element of diplomatic activity that takes place. Seeing as you're in town, you will talk to local officials and discuss issues of mutual interest. But of course, you've got to remember that beyond that, there is a cultural program very often. I guess some of the listeners to the podcast will know that, you know, you'll get Great Britain House and United States House and Russia House, and there are other such activities that run alongside the Olympics. You know, we need to know, would a boycott extend to that? And you know, that's a very interesting one, because those cultural activities very often are premised on doing business. If you go to a US house, for example, at an Olympics, you know, it's all Ralph Lauren and selling things. And so there is an economic interconnectedness between nations and China that if United States was to say, well, we're not going to have a US house, well, yeah, okay, fair enough. But the United States economically, commercially, will potentially suffer as a consequence of that. So these are not decisions that are taken lightly. I think obviously you're then getting into the whole area of sponsors and commercial deals. And I've spoken to several sponsorship people who said, really, to look to the sponsors to take a lead in pushing for a boycott or taking a particular stance is not only wrong, but actually naive. Because inevitably these corporations have paid hundreds of millions of dollars to be associated with the Olympics. Chinese market is a very important one for them. And before you even get to, well, we're not going to send athletes, there are several hurdles to get through. Having said all of that, I think the reason for me, and there's been a lot of criticism of Thomas Bach and the IOC. And their supposed complicity with the Chinese government, which I think again is a little premature and a little too ideologically charged, because Bach can see what ultimately may happen, which is if there is a full-scale athletics boycott, he and the IOC suffer as a consequence of this, and this comes on the back of not just ideologically and politically charged times, but obviously the 2020 Summer Games, which didn't go to plan, and the 2021 Summer Games, which didn't go to plan, to get to 2022, and that doesn't go to plan. And keep in mind, if the US was to boycott Beijing 2022, then we got LA 2028 coming, and the Chinese sure as hell would remember that. So I think that the Bach was less about complicity with China and much more about the potentially very, very serious ramifications, not just next year, but for the next decade possibly, if there was to be a full-scale athletics boycott. And so we are in that territory. I don't think we're necessarily far down the track towards an athletic boycott, but I think we are, you know, some way down the track towards some sort of diplomatic boycott of the event.
And of course, if you look at the origin story of the modern Olympic movement, the modern, and I say modern, not in the kind of the Coubertin way, I mean, in the last 30, 40 years, the Olympics that we see today, the foundations of that come from those back-to-back boycotts in 1884 and trying to create a commercial model that could kind of live outside that and be, you know, insulated, I guess, by Olympic ideals and so on, but kind of keep moving through some of this geopolitical turbulence. And I suppose if you're the IOC, you're not just looking at 28, you're looking at what kind of conversations does the US have with France for 24 and with Italy for 26 about, you know, if China are beginning to talk about a boycott of LA in that time. And then you have a very complicated few years ahead.
And I think from my perspective, as somebody who works in Paris, you know, the French have got a very complex and difficult relationship with the United States, and we know that obviously there have been recent diplomatic episodes involving the two countries, and if the United States was to press France to line up behind it for an athletics boycott, now that then puts France in a very, very difficult position re 2024, and so these are not the kind of quick and easy decisions that I think, you know, that the mass or popular discourse would have us believe about, well, you know, just don't go. China's a nasty country, just don't go there. And I think you're referencing of 80 and 84, and unfortunately, I am old enough to remember these events. You know, these were very different. We're not living in a new Cold War. These were very different times. You know, you could literally say, right, okay, we're not going to go to Russia, and there would not be a significant economic consequence of that. For the United States, and for that matter, Germany, France, Britain, and many others to say, we're not going to China, end of. If that spirals out of control, because of the economic interdependence of our nations and the globalized nature of the world, there would be really serious ramifications for all of us potentially.
I do think if there's a silver lining from the pandemic for the IOC, you know, I do think it provides cover for kind of both sides and for the IOC to sort of say, well, these decisions were taken out of our hands. So, you know, the Chinese can sort of say, well, we didn't want as many people traveling here because of, you know, and the IOC can also say that we're reducing numbers, you know, in terms of the USA House and the you know, Team GB House that Simon was referencing before, you know, they're probably not going to do any of that because there aren't overseas spectators. It's going to be much, much less of a party than a typical Olympics. And so we're having a lot of these conversations and they are interesting discussions, but the final decision often becomes academic because, you know, just decisions are taken because of COVID reasons. And so, you know, I think that's important to remember.
Let's bring it back to the WTA, because I think one of the recurring themes when it comes to China in the last few years, it feels like it's been rights holders in particular who have had programs where they've tried to talk about different social issues. And in the WTA's case, you know, this comes down to an issue of protecting women who've been abused and supporting them and looking for a full investigation of the accusations that Peng has made. And we've seen these collisions between, Simon, the principles and the purpose of rights holders domestically or even within certain countries, and then some of the sensitivity that they're expected to show towards, maybe sensitivity is a slightly too diplomatic word, but towards the desires of the CCP. Is this an indication of rights holders being more aggressive or more, you know, standing their ground a little bit more when it comes to these things? Or is there more going on here? WTA was meant to be in China right now or in the last couple of weeks in Shenzhen, but of course that hasn't happened because of COVID. What are your thoughts on that?
So if I could say from the outset my personal position on this, you know, I'm a great libertarian. You know, I really cherish my right to free speech. You know, look at my Twitter timeline if you don't believe me. And I think equality. I'm somebody who works in education. I've worked in education for 30 years in schools and colleges and universities. So equality, you know, is absolutely central to everything that I do and everything that I believe. So if there is something untoward in the Peng Shuai case, you know, absolutely she's entitled to her opinion. She's entitled to take action. And in my view is if something has happened, she's entitled to justice. But I think that, you know, I go back to the earlier point I made about ideologically binary times. You know, what we think is acceptable here, sat where we are, Owen, you and me, and what people may think, or what politicians more specifically might think in China about what they think is acceptable are two very different things. And it goes back to these, you know, values and norms and cultures that I think are diametrically opposed right now. And I don't think that you know, necessarily people in the West understand China. And I think also people in China don't necessarily understand the West. And so there is that gap. But the whole thing about the Peng case is really unusual because, given who she is, her father is in the police force. Her uncle is a coach in the Chinese tennis system. You know, the fact that Peng came through that system and is in the position that she's in now, there is a possibility that one or more of them are members of the Chinese Communist Party. It is extremely likely that they would have been fully aware that if Peng posted what she did on social media, then there would have been ramifications, not just for her, but for her extended family. I've spoken to people in China who saw her original social media post, and what they've said to me is, yes, there is reference to sexual coercion, but it's not a Me Too call out. You know, essentially what the West has done is to appropriate the issue and to bundle it and to package it and present it as Me Too, whereas, you know, according to people who've read the social media posts, it's about something different to that. And I guess we were going to get there in the end, Owen, in talking about this. One of the things that is happening right now in China is ahead of the National Congress of the Chinese Communist Party next year, President Xi, who is routinely in the business of strengthening his power base and undermining his rivals, particularly his bitter rivals, is currently involved in a takedown of political figures who have been involved in sexual indiscretions. And one of the ways in which that is taking place is through social media. And so I think what we've got to do in the West is, rather than rushing to view this episode in a particular way, in it, you know, certainly in terms of Me Too, you know, and maybe Mark can you know, kind of shed some light on this more from a Chinese perspective. But I think the way in which it's seen in China and the way in which people are consuming the Chinese story in China, and maybe even the way the story actually is in China, are different. And you know, so when Peng is accusing Zhang Gaoli, you know, Zhang is a bitter rival of President Xi's, and President Xi, you know, the template is there, and maybe I'm wrong in seeing this situation through the lens that I'm seeing it, but this looks almost like the takedown of a political rival rather than an episode of Me Too in China. And so in terms of how Western organizations respond to this, my view is that, you know, clearly, you know, we've the whole Me Too movement and the way in which tennis players have been calling this out fits the Western narrative about China very nicely, even though this situation may be something different. But I do find that the WTA's response to it was extremely unusual. So the reason that I think the WTA's response was unusual is that it was very, very fast. If you think about the Daryl Morey NBA case, this went on for some time, and the NBA constantly was trying to equivocate. It was treading the middle way, because it was aware that it needed to keep people at home in the United States happy, but at the same time, try to keep China on side as well. And obviously, commercially, China has been very lucrative for the NBA. In the WTA's case, you know, very quick, but also very, very strident and calling that out very, very quickly. Now, I think in some respects, the WTA is on very safe territory, because, as I've said, the popular global discourse right now is about gender equality. And you know, even in countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, we see a commitment to women's rights and gender equality more generally. So I think the WTA was on very, very safe ground. But I think at the same time too, the WTA has probably made a calculation, and some of the things that Mark has been posting, I think have been really important for me in terms of shaping my view, because, you know, as Mark has said, there's not really any Western tennis going anywhere near China anytime soon. So in terms of that financial or that commercial calculation, that was significant. But I think for me, for the WTA, in making a calculation, probably came up with the answer that they stood to lose far more globally by saying and doing nothing than by actually, you know, saying nothing and letting this all roll, because, you know, the market for tennis right now in China is not particularly healthy. And so I think, you know, it's core business and it's good business for the WTA to call it out and say it as it is, because, you know, in terms of drawing in commercial partners that may well be looking to accentuate their credentials in terms of equality and women's rights, this was really, really significant. And so I think that, you know, the WTA, you know, one part moral, probably one part political, but certainly one part commercial as well.
It's really interesting that Simon mentioned the NBA there, because for me, I think that's when the conversation towards China changed. The NBA thought it was taking a very strong stance initially. Adam Silver thought he was really defending freedom of speech. But in fact, the reaction in the US, and this was just about 2 years ago, October 2019, the reaction in the US was that he was not defending freedom of speech at all. He was pandering to China. And there was a huge backlash in the US. And we've seen many countries, and this is, you know, outside of sports, where a brand has been accused on Chinese social media of making a faux pas. You know, perhaps it's the wrong map and they haven't included this or that or something like that. And they've apologized. And it's pretty much stayed within China. That was the first time, really, sports or otherwise, where it became a global story. And there was a backlash to how companies were acting in China and treating China. There was a backlash in their core market overseas. So I don't know Steve Simon. I got to interview his predecessor at the WTA, Stacey Allister, when she was out here last. So I'm not certainly casting aspersions on why he's made this decision. I think it's whether or not it was the moral decision or commercial implications and so on. But I think that if we widen the picture, the strategy on making decisions with regards to China has changed, because people have to make that, as Simon said, the backlash globally to the WTA, if they hadn't stood up and defended Peng, would have been massive, would have been a huge hit to their reputation. And China's a huge market, but the rest of the world still, at the moment, is a bigger market, particularly when we talk about COVID and the lack of sport that's currently going on right now. The WTA finals should have been in Shenzhen, but it wasn't. They took place in Mexico. They've already had to move on from China, at least in the short term. Who knows how the medium and long term are going to look right now? But I think that NBA incident a couple of years ago did change the way that the China market was treated because of the global interest, which for the first time I think came in there.
Yeah, and I think it could be very interesting as well, because I suppose rights holders have various levers they can pull. They can look to stage events there. They can look at their media business in these countries. They can look at the way that partnerships with sponsors and particularly with suppliers, I'm thinking of sportswear companies, are leveraged in China, and how they get their own brands out there and their team's brands out there. The thing that we might see, I suppose, Simon, is a bit of a dichotomy and a divergence between what rights holders do and what their stance is, and what brands do and what their stance is. I mean, I think you hinted earlier at some of the things that you might hear privately from sponsors, which are, look, we can the sponsorship before we can doing business in China. So it's a very big market for us, and the bottom line is much more readily affected by that.
Yeah, there are two names that immediately come to mind for me. There are several, but there are two that immediately come to mind. The first one is Adidas. And Adidas is the apparel supplier to Peng. And Adidas already suffered a hit earlier this year when it announced that it wouldn't be sourcing cotton from Xinjiang province because it was concerned that that cotton may have been harvested by forced labor in the Uyghur community. And this had a consequence for Adidas, which is that there was a Chinese consumer backlash. Sales in China fell, I think, in the second and third quarters. This is China is a really, really big market for Adidas. And it's also an intensely competitive market too, not just in terms of its battle with Nike, but also with local Chinese brands as well that are growing and getting stronger. So this is a really, really tough one to call. And Adidas has been noticeably silent throughout the Peng case, has not really said anything at all. It's in an incredibly difficult position. And I think politically what the expectation is, from Chinese and the US side, is that you actually line up behind them and you do say something and you do commit. And clearly in this case, Adidas is not prepared to do that. And so it's incredibly complicated terrain to navigate. The other one that stands out for me is Allianz, also German. And if you go on the Allianz website, you'll see Allianz making a huge play on its commitment to LGBT+. And you may remember the case back in summer when Hungary played in the Euros at the arena in Munich. They wanted to light up the stadium in rainbow colours. UEFA said no, but I think Allianz is really committed to LGBTQ+ rights. Allianz is also an IOC partner, a global IOC partner. So, in theory, company representatives should be on the ground in Beijing in February, and they should be activating their deal. But on what basis? The question is, but on what basis? Because right now in China, and again, Mark will know on the ground, certainly from the reporting that I've seen in the West, LGBTQ+ rights in China now are being suppressed. There have been clampdowns online, expressions of LGBTQ+ imagery or statements or values is appears not currently to be acceptable. So, you know, what does Allianz do? You know, and so I think what were you talk about this dichotomy, Owen, and it is almost as though sponsors have to lead a bipolar existence, which is, you know, they exist in one manifestation in China and they exist in a completely different manifestation elsewhere in the world. And you know, how sustainable that is and the extent to which that leads to this kind of cognitive dissonance in the minds of consumers across the world remains to be seen.
We're going to need to wrap this conversation up in a minute and throw to our interview with the DBU. But Mark, one of the things that obviously has been going on in parallel to this has been a bit of a shift in China's relationship with sport globally over the last 5 years or so. You know, there was the visit by Xi Jinping back when David Cameron was Prime Minister of the UK, and he went and visited City Football Group and went to Manchester City training ground and all the rest of it and the National Football Museum. At that point, China was seen as a global citizen within sport. It was a global investor, I think, most pertinently. And you had the CSL as a big spender in the football transfer market, for example. But you also had, you know, Chinese businessmen taking ownership of European clubs. There's been a bit of a retreat in those terms. There have been various reformulations of China's national sporting strategy. What point are we at going into 2022? What position is China in as a prospective host of major events? What position is it in as an investor in international sport? And what kind of role does sport have right now in the Chinese economy?
Let me answer this way. And I'm not sure that it's necessarily changed that much over the years. But, you know, China is first and foremost a political economy. So when you talk about the three strands of politics, business and sports, you know, sports is very much a distant third place. So when sports serves political goals, then great, you know, full steam ahead. When sports serves economic goals, also good. But sports for sport's sake, you know, unfortunately, for a lot of people, a lot of us in the industry, you know, we want just Chinese people playing sports and being healthy, you know, for the sake of sport. That only works and that only kind of ticks boxes when it ticks the more important boxes, you know, i.e. the politics and the economics. So right now, COVID is very much a political goal, and that trumps everything to do with sports. So the response is, well, you know, scrap the Grand Prix, even though we've got a Chinese driver in F1 for the first time. I mean, how huge could that be for global motorsport? And it's such a wasted opportunity because he can't, you know, Zhou Guanyu can't drive in his home race. And who knows what happens after, you know, 2023. Hopefully, he still gets that opportunity. But, you know, I think sometimes we get a little bit too excited about China and sports, and it is the largest single market in the world, and it still has that role to play long term, for sure. I'm not saying it doesn't, but sports is still down the pecking order, and kind of when push comes to shove, we see really how those priorities play out, and it's, like I said, a distant third place in the trio of those three things.
Okay, well, there are so many strands to this, and really thanks to both of you for your thoughts on it. I'm hoping that will be very useful to everybody listening. But yeah, as you both say, lots to untangle, lots to keep an eye on, not just in 2022, but in the years to come. As I mentioned, we have an interview coming up with the chief executive of the Danish Football Union, Jacob Jensen, in just a sec. Simon, in countries where football is a big deal, which is pretty much all of them, we're at a point where we're looking ahead. We're a year to go to the FIFA World Cup in Qatar. So obviously all of these conversations, even though that's further down the line than the Olympics, are front of mind for a lot of people. One of the things we're going to hear about is the DBU's boycott of commercial activities around the World Cup. I'm trying to think of a way of setting you up for some quite pithy thoughts on how this situation is different from what we've got around China. I mean, scale, I suppose, is one thing for Qatar, but
just like the touch paper and stand back. So I think it's a really interesting, Owen, that there are links between the Peng Shuai case and the Qatar World Cup. I think, and for me, it's all about the transparency of governance and government. In the Peng Shuai case, we don't know why she posted what she posted. We don't even know if it was her who posted it. We don't know why Thomas Bach decided to meet her via video call. We don't know what the Chinese government's position is on this. We don't even know why the WTA has taken the stance that it's decided to take. So there are still so many unknowns, which is a reflection of, as I say, some of the issues of governance in not just in sport, but I think more broadly. And how that then rolls over into Qatar, clearly what we have in Qatar is a country and its government who repeatedly tell us that things have changed, that things are different, that they are taking, for example, labor market rights seriously. But at the same time, what we have is clubs, teams, governing associations, countries, governments claiming otherwise. And I think one of the things that many of us don't know about China and we don't know about Qatar and we don't know about labor market rights is has the situation genuinely changed? Instead of telling us that it's changed, where is the tangible evidence? So I think it comes back to this whole issue of transparency and openness. And my feeling about Qatar is in my experience, having been to Qatar, Qatar has changed. And the labor market has changed. The bigger issue is, I think, has it gone far enough and has it gone fast enough? And what will happen once the event is over? But I do think that it is incumbent upon the Qataris, if they want us to believe them, then they have to provide robust evidence and be more open and more transparent about where that data has come from and what is really happening inside labor camps and inside the labor market, for example. And I don't think that's necessarily there at the moment. So for me, it's about governance, it's about transparency, it's about openness. Two more things I would say, and it's also about these different ideologies as well. So if you are Danish and you look at Qatar, you see something very different to, for example, if you're Saudi Arabian and you look at Qatar, or for that matter, and Mark's still with us, if you're Chinese and you look at Qatar. So I think we all look at other countries through a particular, kind of ideological and sociocultural lens, and what we see is not necessarily what others see. And the final thing that I would say on this is just to reiterate again the point that I made earlier about interdependence. I think it's very, very interesting. Whilst there's been a clamour in Norway for a boycott of Qatar, the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund has actually got $10 billion invested in Qatar. And it's conceivable that the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund could actually be invested into assets that have been constructed using immigrant labour. And we don't know, how has that immigrant labour been treated in Qatar? So we live in a very ambiguous and very interconnected world. And I think many of us are complicit, not just in creating those problems, but we have to also be complicit in generating the solutions as well.
And on the subject of ambiguity and kind of the slightly uncomfortable line, shall we say, that's going to be walked over the next 12 months, I'd suggest people seek out an interview that Amanda Davis did at CNN with Nasser Al-Khaitar, who's the chief exec of Qatar 2022, where she talks about, the rights of the LGBTQ community in the country, and he is trying to provide some reassurance in a way that doesn't offend local sensitivities. It's quite extraordinary stuff. But anyway, we will leave our thoughts there for now, and we will throw over to Sports Press staff writer Rory Jones, who has been talking to Danish Football Union chief exec Jacob Jensen about the Qatar boycott and also about the country's hopes to host the Women's European Championship. That's coming up just after this.
So, Jakob, thank you very much for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you very much. And I'm impressed by your pronunciation of my name, which is almost as in Danish.
Well, we do make sure to be accurate with that. And I think what might help is the fact I was in Denmark last week. So maybe maybe that worked to my advantage this time. But
good on you.
Just to cut to the chase here with regards to this interview. So obviously, a couple of weeks ago on November 17th, the DBU announced that the Denmark national football team will be taking a number of critical measures ahead of the World Cup in Qatar. Obviously, these including Denmark will not participate in any activities arranged by the event organisers during the event. In addition to that, the team will wear, on a more visible level, the team will wear training apparel which displays messages supporting human rights throughout the tournament, in which I believe your sponsors have accommodated. And in addition, you'll make limited trips to Qatar during the tournament. So first of all, would you be able to explain your decision to take this stance? What were some of the main factors that led to this?
Yes, certainly. And I think it's important for you to know that we did not just take a stand right now. We've been working on this for several years. The DBU, the Danish FA, did not support or did not vote. We couldn't even vote when the World Cup was awarded to Qatar. We find it problematic that it will be held in Qatar because there are many problems with, for instance, human rights, sustainability, environmental issues, the tournament being played in December because of the temperature and so on. So we've been working very intensely for many months and many years. We've visited Qatar twice. We'll visit Qatar again in December. And basically, I think one should acknowledge that progress has been made in Qatar, for instance, in terms of migrant worker rights. You do see legislation coming forward. You do see reforms being implemented. Last week also, a few weeks ago, Amnesty International pointed out that the implementation was a lot slower than one could have hoped for. This is not the first report showing this fact. And we do believe that the eyes of the world will be on Qatar even more strongly now after the qualification has ended for many teams. So we think the coming year should be a year where we all try to stand together in order to improve the conditions of migrant workers and the human rights in Qatar. So we've taken a lot of initiatives, and the initiative that we showed on November 17 was after our last qualification match. We've had a lot of dialogue with our commercial partners. We still are in dialogue with the commercial partners on how to express ourselves in order to improve conditions for migrant workers, basically. And those initiatives should be seen in the light of this discussion. We will take... we will now follow the development closely in Qatar and see if it will be necessary to present even more initiatives. But we have our eyes on the ball, and we'll keep on developing and what we can do in order to push for the improvement for the conditions of the migrant workers.
So, I mean, as you mentioned there, the eyes of the world will be on Qatar in about a year's time. During the World Cup, I don't think the stage gets much bigger than that. But still being a year out from the tournament, and Denmark qualified recently for that, why did you decide to reveal this stance now?
I think it's important to stress that Denmark did not qualify just recently. We qualified as the third country in the world after Qatar and Germany already in October. So we were one of the first teams qualifying. And the timing was we had something prepared for after the ending of the qualification tournament. So that was basically our reasons for presenting the initiatives on November 17 after a very good dialogue with our commercial partners and awaiting in respect also all the qualification matches being played.
I mean, we've seen that the issue has been raised by a number of different parties in the build-up to this tournament, and that's been going on for some time. I guess back in March, we first saw Norway taking a stance, wearing T-shirts, displaying support, messages of support for human rights. In addition to that, we've seen Amnesty International recently publish their reports. But are you expecting any other countries to take a similar stance ahead of next year's tournament?
I think it's important to note that it didn't start in March. It started in 2015 on our part. So we've had a long dialogue. We've been writing letters. We've been visiting Qatar, discussing with Amnesty International, the ILO, many other parties. So this is just another step in a very long journey that we've had, basically. And now on other countries, I mean, that's for each country to decide. I hope that other countries certainly will also participate. I think it's in the interest of all countries of the world to improve the conditions of migrant workers and to put focus on the conditions that you see in Qatar. We have a very strong cooperation with the other Nordic countries. Unfortunately, there's only going to be one other Nordic country that might qualify, which is Sweden, as Norway, Iceland, the Faroe Islands, and Finland did not qualify. But we've been writing letters together, been taking meetings together. Recently, we wrote a common letter to FIFA trying to have them explain how two Norwegian journalists could be arrested in Qatar, as they were just last week. And certainly, I know many other countries are also interested in the debate. We've been having earlier, we've been cooperating very well with, for instance, the Netherlands and Belgium. UEFA is now planning a trip for all 55 member associations. So, you know, I think this proves that more countries will take part. And as the World Cup comes nearer, more countries will join this task we have on improving conditions in Qatar.
Just to follow up on that, what impact do you hope that this will have in taking this stance? And also, as you've mentioned, being involved in talks with Qatar ahead of the tournament, and other countries, I'm sure, will be involved in some capacity in working with Qatar in order to ensure that if they do choose to take up a stance, that it's obviously they're familiar and that they can work together and share their views on that. But what impact do you hope this will have?
I hope this will have a clear impact on improving conditions for migrant workers, on improving human rights. I think it's important to stress that we have seen progress in Qatar. We have seen, for instance, minimum wage being introduced, the kafala system being abolished, different pieces of legislation on under what temperatures you're allowed to work. Amnesty also, in not the last report, but the former report, showed that I believe in May or June last year, more than 200 companies in Qatar were closed down because they did not live up to the regulations on under what temperatures you're allowed to work. So I think it's important to stress that we have seen progress, and this progress has made substantial changes for, I believe, thousands of migrant workers in Qatar. And obviously, what we're hoping for is that these improvements will be implemented at a better rate, even more rapidly, and that more reforms will be introduced so that the human rights issue in Qatar will be standing as strongly as never before when the World Cup is being played, and it will leave a lasting legacy on the region on how to improve human conditions, so human rights conditions. So I think we're hoping for even more changes taking place, more improvements, more rapid implementation of reforms and more reforms.
Great, thank you very much. I think you've definitely outlined that, and I sure hope to see some of those reforms you've talked about be implemented before this time next year when the tournament gets underway. But just to move on now to on the Women's Euro with regards to the joint Nordic bid to host the Women's Euro 2025 tournament, being involved with the football governing bodies of Sweden, Norway and Finland as well. So what can you tell us about this bid for the Women's Euro in 2025? And why could the Nordic countries be the best host for the event?
Well, I think it's important to know that at this point, there is no formal bid yet. What UEFA has called for is sort of a sign of interest and five groups of countries or countries have shown their interest. We have a bid, we're preparing a bid, not only among the countries that you just mentioned, but it's also being supported by the Faroes, the Faroe Islands and Iceland, But the main actors are the four countries that that you mentioned, and obviously we're hoping to win the bid, and we're hoping to have a fantastic Euro tournament in the Nordic countries. We do believe we have a lot to offer. We've had for many years women's football on a very good journey. We've had some very good women's football teams in the Nordic countries. We do believe we have a legacy of gender equality that we'd like to show the world. If you look, for instance, at women's participation rate in the labor market, if you take the Nordic region as such, it is second to none. If you take the leave being maternity and paternity leave being shared by parents, we do see more sharing in the Nordic countries than you see in many other countries. So, and these are just two examples. We do believe that we have a lot to offer in women's football. We do believe that we have a very strong policy on improving women's conditions, and we have a strong history for that. And we're hoping that we'll be able to show the entire world our beautiful countries as well as our legacy and improve women's football in the Nordic countries.
Certainly a compelling argument you put forward there. But what do you believe that hosting this tournament could do specifically for the growth of women's, as you've mentioned already, I think with regards to a number of high-profile players coming from Denmark in addition to that, the likes of Pernille Harder, and I'm sure there'll be an end goal there to inspire future generations of women's soccer players or football players in Denmark. But how, to what extent can this tournament really contribute towards that and really drive growth and further development of the women's game?
First of all, I believe you're absolutely right. I can only talk for Denmark. We've got some fantastic football players. Pernille Harder, one of the best players in the world, and a lot of very good players also beside Pernille Harder. And our team has been doing really well. Obviously, this is an important task for me and for the Football Association, as well as the clubs, to make sure that if we do get to host the Euros, it will certainly improve women's football and girls football in Denmark. Now, if you take the last major tournament we hosted, which was the Men's Euros, at this point, we have no statistics on the entire country, but we do hear from a lot of football clubs that young boys are really trying to play football. They want to start playing football now after this huge celebration we had, not just in Copenhagen or in Denmark for that matter, but in all of Europe this last summer. And you do see effects that more children are wanting to play football now. And it's our task and responsibility to make sure that they will have a leisure activity that is very good, that, you know, that we have good trainers, that the clubs are ready to have all these young people and children enter their clubs. So we have an example from the Men's Euros that we do believe that we, and I hope we'll be able to copy for the Women's Euros should we win the bid.
As you mentioned there, being with Copenhagen being one of the host cities during Euro 2020 in the summer, being one of the few countries which was selected, and obviously that being one of the first major events with fans back in person and being able to attend matches as well. With regards to that, what do you think you kind of learned from that experience of hosting a tournament of that scale?
I think first of all we learned a lot about the potential of togetherness that you can actually achieve when you do have a very good football team, a good tournament, a good setting. We have a slogan saying we're part of something bigger, and we really felt that this summer the entire country gathered, obviously behind the terrible incident with Christian Eriksen, but also after that, for the entire journey of our team, who made it all the way to the semifinals at Wembley. So we have an experience on how huge a potential we have to engage the entire country, or maybe even Europe all in all. Now, secondly, obviously, we do have very concrete experiences on, you know, logistics. How do you get the volunteers to work? How do you promote the best experience in the stadiums where the tournament is taking place? How do you work together with commercial partners? We've had a big team working on this for years in order to prepare the Euros on the men's side. And all the experiences of this team, we can put forward and utilize if we were to win the Women's Euros bid.
Yeah, I think definitely with the story of Denmark during Euro 2020 was probably one of the most powerful, one of the biggest stories we saw during that tournament, and the way that panned out. But in the way that the country sort of rallied behind that Danish men's national team, is that sort of what you're hoping in any potential bid for the women's tournament, that it could almost galvanize the country in a similar way?
Yeah, exactly. That's what we're hoping for. And as a good example of that, we had our women playing the final at the last Euros. We lost the final, unfortunately, against the Netherlands, but we had played a really good tournament. And we saw exactly the same effect. So the country rallied behind the women's teams. A lot of Danes traveled down there for the semifinals and for the finals in the Netherlands. Huge parties taking place all over the country for the women's games. So we've already seen that we're able to have the country behind the national team on the women's side. And the experience from the men's Euros this summer makes us believe even stronger that it will certainly be possible once again.
And yeah, just one final question on that. If this bid were to be successful, what would success mean for you? What would be the absolute main thing that you'd hope to take away from that?
I would hope to take away two things. First of all, I hope that once again we would be able to have all the countries, all the Nordic countries as well as the European countries, stand together and gather for a celebration of football and be inspired by our women's teams. And secondly, I would hope that a successful tournament would have even more female football players enter the football club and leave a lasting legacy on the development of women's football in the Nordic countries.
Well, Jakob, thank you very much for your time, and all the best to you with regards to that potential bid for the Women's Euros in 2025.
Thanks a lot. It's been a pleasure. All the best.
Okay, that is it for another Sports Pro podcast. Thank you to Rory Jones and to Jakob Jensen. Thank you to Professor Simon Chadwick.
Thank you, Owen, and thank you, Mark. Good to see and hear you again, Mark.
Yeah, thank you very much to Mark Dreyer.
No, thank you for having me on. Looking forward to another Olympics around the corner here, but I think it's going to be a very, very different one to 2008.
Well, plenty to watch out for, of course, in 2022, but we're going to leave it there. Thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back with you again very soon. Bye-bye.
The Sports Pro podcast is published by Sports Pro Media.